when I went to school, we didn't learn anything about the people involved. As an accounting major, I looked at numbers and projections and charts and all that, but no one ever mentioned the fact that one of the most important aspects of analyzing a business opportunity is to look at the people involved.
Welcome to Off the Record, a podcast featuring leaders on IBJ Media's Indiana 250 list. I'm Nate Feltman, CEO of IBJ Media, which publishes the Indiana 250, a list of the most influential business people in the state. Today, I'm joined by Mickey Maurer, a member of our inaugural Indiana 250 class, who I know both as a friend, mentor, and business partner. Mickey served as the first president of the Indiana Economic Development Corporation and Secretary of Commerce under Governor Mitch Daniels. I was fortunate enough to follow Mickey as Indiana Secretary of Commerce, and then later we became partners at IBJ Media. But Mickey's time in state government and at IBJ Media don't even scratch the surface of the Mickey Maurer story. An Indianapolis native, Mickey comes from a family of entrepreneurs. His dad and uncle owned Maurer Brothers Auto Parts in downtown Indianapolis and later owned Rex Incorporated, which for decades had a distinctive sign along I-65 just northwest of the city. And Mickey's Uncle Sid owned the old Atlas Supermarket on College Avenue.
You know, that sign, you remember what the sign said? It said, "We meet by accident." And my mother came up with that idea.
It's awesome because you're driving along I-65 and it was a great sign. Mickey has more than done his part to keep the Maurer entrepreneurial spirit alive. After graduating from North Central High School, Mickey went to the University of Colorado and got a degree in accounting before coming back to Indiana and earning a law degree from Indiana University's School of Law in Bloomington, which now bears his name.
That's very ironic, isn't it? Because I think I had the lowest GPA of the entering class.
After graduating from law school, Mickey practiced law in New York City for a time. He eventually returned home and started a small law firm here, but practicing law didn't scratch Mickey's entrepreneurial itch. He became an owner of cable television systems and racquetball courts back in the 70s when racquetball was the hottest sport. Those investments and others paid off handsomely, and Mickey, then in his 40s, decided to retire. But Mickey flunked retirement. It's probably the only thing he's failed at. He missed the satisfaction of identifying business opportunities and capitalizing on them, making deals and creating value, so he got back in the game. He bought radio stations, real estate, started the National Bank of Indianapolis with his cousin Maury, and bought IBJ Media. He even made a movie, Diving In, which had a national release and made money overseas.
But overall, lost money.
That would have been more than enough for most people, but Mickey is also dedicated to his community and believes strongly in giving back. So in 2004, when Governor Mitch Daniels came calling and asked Mickey to help lead the state's economic development efforts, he said yes and took on the challenge laid down by Governor Daniels of reinvigorating the state's economy.
For a dollar a year.
That wasn't the extent of Mickey's service to our city and state. He served on boards of numerous businesses and non-for-profits, and has also led numerous boards, including serving as president of the Jewish Community Relations Council, chairman of the board of the Indianapolis Zoological Society, and chair of the United Way of Central Indiana. He's also been loyal to his alma mater, the IU School of Law in Bloomington, which was renamed the Indiana University Maurer School of Law in 2008 in recognition of his financial support and service to the school. Mickey is also the creator of Mickey's Camp, which started in 2001 as a way for adults to go back to camp and learn new skills, network, and recharge in an informal atmosphere, all while raising money for charity. Mickey's Camp for Men was joined a few years later by Mickey's Camp for Women. Both of his camps are signing up new campers right now, and we're going to talk a little bit more about Mickey's Camp in just a few minutes. Some of the things campers have an opportunity to learn are hobbies Mickey has dabbled in over the years, including his woodworking creations and underwater photography, which have won blue ribbons at the Indiana State Fair. And his crossword puzzles have been published in the New York Times. He had a regular column in Indianapolis Business Journal for more than 25 years and has published numerous books. Not all of Mickey's pastimes are cerebral or creative. In 1998, he successfully scaled Mount Kilimanjaro, the highest peak in Africa. Mickey, your interests are so varied, it's hard to capture them all in a podcast intro, but I think I did a decent job and scratched the surface. So thank you for being with us today, Mickey, and welcome to Off the Record Podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here, Nate, especially with you, who I've had such enjoyable moments of working together over the years. And I'll take this opportunity to wish you well in your new endeavor, which is 100% ownership of this wonderful institution, Indianapolis Business Journal.
I'm honored to do it. You've been a great mentor, as I mentioned in the intro, and I just hope to continue the tradition at IBJ Media just as strongly as you have, Mickey. So thank you. I mentioned just now that you're a crossword puzzle creator. How long have you been making crossword puzzles, and how did you manage to get your crossword puzzles published in the New York Times?
Well, I think we've been doing this, making puzzles for the New York Times, for more than 20 years. And when I first began doing that, there was a real snob who was the editor of the New York Times, and he wouldn't publish any new creators. So we had to pull a fraud on him. We pretended that Indianapolis had a crossword puzzle club. And we invited him to speak at our club, to come in. Of course, there was no crossword puzzle club. And he would constantly write back and forth, tell me about your club, how many members, and we would never say anything. Just send him money to come in. And we came in, we put an ad in our paper, and I said, please come. This Eugene Maleska, the editor, is going to be here. And we told everybody that they would be part of our crossword puzzle club. And when we got here, it turned out he was a Boston Celtics fan, a big Larry Bird fan. So we gave him an autographed ball and talked him into publishing people from Indianapolis who had never published, including me. So that's what got us started.
And was that Will Shortz?
No, Will Shortz came much later. I had published a number of puzzles with Eugene Maleska at the New York Times before Will Shortz came along. Unfortunately, Eugene passed away. And at the time, he had already accepted for publication maybe five or six of my puzzles. They were in line to be put into paper. Will Shortz came along, bundled all those up and sent them back and said they didn't meet his criteria. So I had to start all over with Will Shortz.
He's an IU graduate.
An IU graduate from Crawfordsville, Indiana.
And I know he's been at Mickey's camp before, because I can remember him teaching how do you make a crossword puzzle at Mickey's camp.
That's right. And he's been more than once. Right now he's recuperating from a stroke, and we're all hoping a speedy recovery for Will Shortz.
I want to turn back to newspapers. And when you bought the IBJ, you and Bob Schloss, you hadn't been a newspaper owner before. And I know you're a top salesman, because I've been with you on pitches, and I know there's nobody better in the business of sales than you. But was there a learning curve when you became an owner of the IBJ in terms of the journalism side and what that was all about?
Absolutely, Nate. And that's probably the thing I like best about the IBJ, because I like businesses with steep learning curve. In fact, with my short attention span, once I learn, I'm not as interested as I was before. But wow, the IBJ did present a steep learning curve. I had some experience from law school, being on the editing the law journal and related matters like that, but it doesn't compare to the excitement of a newspaper.
In your book that I've read several times, that I recommend, by the way, to anybody who's enthusiastic about being an entrepreneur, in your book, 10 Essential Principles of Entrepreneurship, one of your principles, or at least one of the things that you quote in there, is never fall in love with your business. And I think you're talking about, gosh, don't be blind to when it's time to exit and so forth. But you write in the book that you broke the rule of never falling in love with your business when it came to the IBJ. What was different about IBJ Media, maybe compared to some of the other businesses?
Well, I know you know the answer to that question because you're working here, and I understand you're enjoying it as much as I did. But I would cite that the folks here are bright, and add to that curious individuals. There's a joy to working at the IBJ in scooping other media, in promoting good people from Indiana and their businesses. It's a wonderful psychological boost when you can do things like that. And I like to think the IBJ is an important member of the business community.
For sure. And I get that feedback a lot. In your book, you talk about a lot of different principles that are practical in nature. And one of my favorite is the people principle. Can you talk a little bit about what that means when you talk about the people are an important part of business?
remember the end of that title of that book was Lessons That You Never Learned in School. And I maintain, at the time, at least I went into school, when I went to school, we didn't learn anything about the people involved. As an accounting major, I looked at numbers and projections and charts and all that. But no one ever mentioned the fact that one of the most important aspects of analyzing a business opportunity is to look at the people involved. So that's one of my important principles in that 10 Principles book, the people involved. Right now, when I get an opportunity to look at a potential deal and they send me all these facts and figures, I don't look at anything until I find out who's involved, their competency, their track record, their collegiality, all the things I need to learn about people. That's the people principle. Do that first. And if that doesn't please you, then don't do the deal.
That's one that I've learned a lot from you on that one, especially when we were working together at the IEDC, the Indiana Economic Development Corporation, because you'll remember we got approached from all parts and all different types of people. And sometimes when we didn't have confidence in people, we knew the project wasn't going anywhere. So I buy into that one. Mickey, you've written a lot of different books now. You, of course, 19 Stars of Indiana that are about well-accomplished, well-known and accomplished Hoosiers, both men and women. And you've also written a fiction book. What type of book is your favorite to write?
Well, of course, it was great to write those two books, Men and Women of Potential Influencers in Indiana, the 19 Stars books. At the time I wrote it, they were all alive, all 19 times two. And today, unfortunately, many have passed away. Those books sold out. Made me feel very good that people cared as much as I did about learning about famous Hoosiers who could influence our young children, our students. And they're in all the schools now. So I'm really pleased with that. But the other side of that question is I'm writing a book now, and so it's a sequel to my fiction book. And to answer the question, the book that I like the best is the one I'm writing, always. I'm learning and trying to create and having a lot of fun with writing a new book. So that's my favorite book right now.
Well, a couple of businesses, going back to not falling in love with your business, a couple of businesses that apparently you didn't fall in love with, maybe, were cable TV and radio stations. And with those, you seem to have impeccable timing in terms of when you got into them, when the business was growing and it was hot, and then the foresight maybe to exit those businesses when things maybe you saw around the corner and saw something others didn't see. How much luck is involved or was involved in those businesses and the timing of decision of when to sell?
Well, I'll quote, I think it was Louis Pasteur who said, in the course of human endeavor, luck favors the prepared mind. Again, going back to those rules, the schools, they tell you when's a good time to enter a business, but they never teach you when is a good time to exit. So in my chapter about whether it's time to fold them, it's when there's a looming adverse change to the industry. And I recognize that in a couple places, like cable television, which was just doing very, very well, but that peek around the corner saw a dish. It saw entertainment that you could put in your shirt pocket. I'm reminded of a guy that worked for me at the radio stations who was a disc jockey on the side, and he would pay football players to haul in milk cartons full of record albums that he could play. And now all he has to do is take one device, put it in his shirt pocket, and walk in and have more music than he ever had. So there was this looming adverse change. Our entertainment sources was changing. And I thought, it's probably time to exit cable TV. And nobody saw that looming adverse change. Hardly anybody did. And so we did very well with the exit in the radio and the cable TV.
Well, I mentioned in the intro your family tradition of entrepreneurism. What are some of the lessons that you learned from family members that served you well in business through the years?
I worked at my father's junkyard. You were nice enough to call it auto parts, but it was used auto parts. It was a junkyard. And that's where negotiation took place at its most basic form. So that's what I learned, the art of negotiation. That somebody would come in and want to buy a tire. and we had tires. And so I would, and every tire was different wear, different make, different size. And so I would try to sell that potential customer a tire and negotiate with them on a price. And if I didn't sell the tire, the customer would leave and I'd put the tire back in inventory. That did us no good at all. But if I sold the tire at a very low price, then that wasn't a good result. So it's a balancing effect of negotiation. And to make it even more difficult at the time, I started there at 10 years old. So everybody thought they could out-negotiate or take advantage of a boy. And so I had to be at the best I could be. And so that's a good, I guess you'd say it's where the tire met the road.
Yeah, right.
It was a good experience for me learning the art of negotiation. And also you want to leave your negotiating partner with some sense of accomplishment because you want the guy to not be upset and you want him to come back and buy another tire. And so there's a lot to learn there. And that's what I learned.
I remember it just brought to mind a memory when we were negotiating deals at the IEDC. And you said to me, and it sticks with me, when the guy across from you negotiate with you says yes and agrees to your deal, get the hell out of the room as fast as you can before he changes his mind.
Yeah, that's what I like to tell folks who ask, that after you have a deal, everything that can happen after that is bad. So you're right. You quoted me correctly. And do you apply that principle then?
I've been trying hard to apply that.
Yeah, so when you bought the IBJ from me, did you get the hell out of the room?
I got the hell out of the country. I went to South America for
No, you were very smart.
So speaking of the IBJ, when you bought the IBJ back in 1990, the IBJ was owned by an out-of-state ownership group. And I know from working with you closely back at the IEDC how important local ownership is to you. And I know it's one of the reasons why you started the National Bank of Indianapolis. Can you tell our listeners why local ownership is so important and maybe even a tidbit about the beginning of the National Bank of Indianapolis?
I'll start with the first part of your question. Probably all our listeners know how important local ownership is and probably have lived through the good things that our local business can do for our community. Maybe I can illustrate that with the story about a bank, National City Bank, which bought Merchants Bank when Merchants got in a lot of trouble. There is no Merchants and there is no National City, so I can't very well get in any trouble by talking about those two banks. But I recall that the National City Bank was from Cleveland, and the first thing they did after they closed their deal was to lower their United Way pledge. So, I mean, that's not illustrate the fact that I'm sure they were good citizens in Cleveland, but doesn't that illustrate the fact that local ownership is important? So that was an illustration of that point. Yes, I started the National Bank of Indianapolis because I was unhappy with the National City folks about how they treated local customers. And I thought a locally owned bank would do a lot better job, and I think we have. So our bank has a commitment to make a charitable contribution to every single customer of ours who's a not-for-profit that asks us to contribute, 100%. That's a record that should be emulated by every locally owned business, not necessarily by those that are operated from out of state.
Let's take a quick break. This is Off the Record Podcast.
Get caught up on the state's top business news every business day with the Inside Indiana Business Radio On Demand podcast. Available now at InsideIndianaBusiness.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Off the Record Podcast. I'm Nate Feltman, CEO of IBJ Media, and I'm talking with well-known entrepreneur and public servant, Mickey Maurer. When I mentioned in my intro about you working and saying yes for Mitch Daniels and economic development when he was elected governor, there, of course, I got the opportunity to work alongside you, and there was an effort across the board to lure in-state, out-of-state investment and grow more opportunities in our state. Talk a minute about the charge that you received from Governor Daniels. What did he say to you when he offered the job in terms of what he wanted to accomplish for the state?
Well, first of all, I told him I'd do it for $1 a year. And so I was pleased to contribute my time. We had just closed on some business deal. I forgot what it was. And I thought the more success you have in your community, the bigger your obligation is to give back. And so I was feeling a large obligation at the time. And so I told the governor I'd do it for $1 a year. And so I was pleased to do that.
So what was Mitch's focus?
Like, Mitch wanted to raise the average income of Indiana citizens. And that was a big number with a big base. So very difficult job to do. But we brought some discipline, and you were a big help to us, Nate. And so was Chad Sweeney, who was working on part of our team, to analyze carefully the impact of every deal we made as to how much it cost us per job and what it did to the average income, because that was our charge. And as a result of that analysis, we were disciplined and we were able to couch our deals in a way that were business-like and that were profitable to the state of Indiana. One mantra we adopted is we aren't going to give any money away unless we had to, and only enough to bring in the business. Our predecessors just, I thought, didn't have that discipline.
And you instilled that discipline, and I was witness of that in terms of doing that analysis and really the actual negotiation of deals so that it was for the benefit of the taxpayers, as you articulated. When you think about those 2 years of contributing your time, is there one big deal or a deal that sticks out in your mind as the one that you thought?
I do remember the deal where an automobile assembler, major automobile assembler, headquarters in Japan, wanted us to provide a large incentive to set up shop in the state of Indiana. And through some source or another, we learned that they were pretty well along in making a deal to lease an assembly line in Lafayette and get started without having to build a factory. And in fact, that there were employees that were able to step right in and help them manufacture their vehicles. And so when they asked us for these large incentives by pushing across the table contracts that they had been offered in other states that involved many millions of dollars, and we answered the question, how much are you willing to give us? And I'd say nothing. And they were flabbergasted. And I think that we ended up building a right-of-way and providing some education for them, but incentives were close to zero. And I said, the reason is we know you're coming anyway.
I remember that one well. So the other big one that I remember that you were masterful at and really was the art of the deal was, of course, Honda in Greensburg. And that one is representative in that, as you'll recall, Mitch had... Right away, he called over to us when we started our jobs and said, hey, we need to go to Japan because the governor hadn't been to Japan in so long. And he knew from his business experiences what it meant for us to go there to meet with executives on their turf and tell them how much we would value their investment. We did that. And one of the first big, big wins for Mitch and for our team at the IEDC was Honda. And I remember, though, it was a complicated deal. And you brought a lot of course, smarts and creativity to making a site work in Indiana.
Yeah, I think we were criticized because we found the only site in Indiana with a railroad track going right through the middle. And of course, that made it more difficult. I do also remember the news conference that Mitch Daniels held just before we were to leave. And there were TV and radio and newspaper were all there. And they said, Mitch, are you going to go over to Japan and make a deal? And he said, well, no, with the Japanese, it's a slower process. You thank them for the business we have, and you get to know them, and you exchange ideas and information, and you bring it along slowly. He said, dealing with the Japanese, you need diplomacy and tact and patience. And I was sitting next to him on the couch during this interview, and I elbowed him and I said, whispered, Mitch, I don't have any of those qualities.
Exactly. And he was glad you didn't. And the job that you had, you didn't want to have those qualities. Speaking of Mitch, I know you hold him in high regard. Is there something or what is it about his leadership style that you admire, and how does it maybe square with some of your leadership philosophy?
I like the idea that he can delegate. Eventually, there was a trust that grew up. And when things became a little problematical in our department, he would just say, talk to Mickey about that. Because people needed to learn that they can't go to the governor every time they're unhappy with something the Indiana Economic Development Corporation did. So finally, well, not finally, I mean, early on.
People were testing. They were testing.
Yeah, early on, I learned that the governor was trusting us and could delegate, and we appreciated that. So I think as part of my philosophy, I try to delegate as much as I can under the idea that if something goes wrong, I'm still there and I'll get another chance at that idea or that decision.
It's a really important philosophy, and I know that you do have that philosophy in common. So one of your mentors, Mickey, and I know because I've heard you talk about him and often, is Gene Glick, who was a very accomplished real estate developer, of course, very well known for developing apartments throughout the Midwest and country. Remind our audience what your association with Gene Glick was and maybe a tidbit about what you learned from Gene.
After I served a year in New York as a tax lawyer, I wanted to come back to Indianapolis because I thought this was a great place to bring up children, and I was going to have some. And so I interviewed with Gene Glick, and he offered me a job, and the title was his feasibility analyst. Now, I was only in my 20s at the time, and so it gave me an opportunity to learn from a master, Gene Glick, and learn his administration systems and his philosophy with regard to philanthropy. So I learned a lot from Gene Glick, and it was not a formal, but a strong informal mentorship relationship.
Is one of the things you learn, I'm curious, one of the things that I know you're adamant about is that when somebody calls you or leaves you a message, that you get back to them within 24 hours. And we instituted that at the IEDC because we said, and you said, we're not going to operate at the speed of government. We're going to operate at the speed of business. But was that something that you learned from Gene?
It was something I learned while I was at Gene. He had me do a report, and I had to interview to get the material and learn enough to be able to write the report. I had to interview somebody named Jackson, who was an apartment developer on the South Side. And Jackson wouldn't return my call. And then Gene, his office would call and say, where's that report? And so I didn't know what to do, and it bothered me. And I vowed that anybody ever wanted me to return a call, I would do it on the same day. And I've tried to instill that in people that work for me, and I still do that. We return our calls. This is something sometimes it's impossible to do for others, but I do it. I take every single request for a meeting. I have every meeting that anybody ever wants me to be at. And, you know, it's funny, there's an exception. I don't have lunch with anybody unless they're a friend. So it gives me a middle of the day to relax and be with friends. Not that we can't transact business. So if I've returned you down a few times for lunch, then you know that I'm not a real buddy of yours. But we have lunch, don't we?
We have lunch often.
Okay, so then you are a buddy.
I'm a buddy.
Yeah.
And you don't do breakfasts, do you?
No, it's hard to get up that early because actually I'm a night person and I work at night, not in the middle of the night, but I just function a little bit better toward the end of the day than in the beginning of the day.
Well, in the intro, I mentioned that you decided to retire at an early age, I think at 40 or right around 40, after you've had some business success. And some would say, gosh, that was my dream. I want to retire. I made some money and I want to retire. But you had a different kind of experience when you made that decision. Tell us about why retirement didn't work out for you.
That is a dream of most people. I want to make enough money and then retire and then do whatever I want to do. And I don't have to work anymore. Well, that American dream is a nightmare. It's a nightmare. I did retire. I sold my businesses. I invested in tax-free bonds, safe, double A or better, and relaxed and thought, okay, I'm going to live the American dream. But the problem with that was I failed to take into consideration the psychological benefit of working, of making a deal, of people caring about what I had to say, of trying to be creative, So it was horrible. You can only work out so much.
And you weren't a golfer, right?
No. I would lift weights and stuff like that, and leisure, lunch. And I'd come back to the office. Where's my mail? And I was running before I did all that. I had three different law practice and two other businesses I was running. But there was no mail, no junk mail. More of my telephone messages. And they used to be a stack of pink slips. No more. I said, this is not going to work. So I reversed course.
How long did you retire for? How long did that take before you reversed
course?
Well,
it didn't take very long before I began to put another group of businesses together. But I didn't get it all accomplished right away. But within a year or so, I was busier than ever and liking it more.
You mentioned earlier that Gene Glick had an affinity for philanthropy and that maybe some of that rubbed off on you in terms of giving back to the community. I know it's a passion of yours. You've done it in so many different ways. But Mickey's Camp, I think, grew out of that passion of wanting to give back to the community. Tell us how Mickey's Camp came about.
I was having dinner with my wife at a friend's house. And after dinner, you probably had the same experience. Men went in one room and women went in another. Well, we went in this guy's den and there was a pool table and we played pool for money. Not very much, really. It wasn't major money, but there was a stake involved and it kindled my competitive instinct, but I was horrible. So I went home disappointed and I made a list of the things I wasn't any good at. My wife went in the room and added a couple of things to that list. We'll go on from there. And then I contracted with the YMCA camp in Shelbyville, Indiana, and leased their camp after their regular camp programming was completed for a week. And then I contacted the experts and professionals that I identified from around the country who taught those skills that I needed. And they readily agreed when I told them that it was going to be a not-for-profit endeavor. We're going to raise money for charity. And many of these great people came for nothing. Sometimes I reimbursed their expenses. Sometimes there was a modest fee, and sometimes it was for nothing. And so we launched the first camp. I wanted 100 people, penciled it out, and figured I could raise a good amount of money for charity. If I had 100, that would cover my fixed costs and make some money for charity. And so we launched it. And that's how it all came about.
And now it's 23, 24 years later. Is that right?
Yeah, it's much more than 20 years later. We raised millions of dollars for Central Indiana Charities. And we still have a very strong interest in coming to camp. It's a first come, first served. It's not by invitation. And people thought, I never got invited to Mickey's Camp. Well, nobody did.
That's right.
It's first come, first served.
As you know, it holds a special place in my heart because that's where we met. And so IBJ has gotten involved the last couple of years in Mickey's Camp. I'm personally loving our partnership and working with you because I'm so passionate about it. And I've met so many wonderful people at Mickey's Camp and had the opportunity to contribute to great charities.
Yeah, your story with me, our story together, is one of many stories of successful meetups at Mickey's Camp.
So charities get to present. There's a few charities every year they get to present. And then campers, of course, get to choose with part of their camp fee to contribute to the charity of their choice. Are there any causes besides just Mickey's Camp charities? Are there causes that you're really passionate about today that you are spending more time with?
When I was a young lad going to law school, and you mentioned that, my father was very smart about not giving me any money that I didn't need to spend immediately. So I got always just enough, but no more. And I came back from law school after the first year, and I put together a good academic record, one that qualified me for a scholarship that I wasn't even aware of. And I forgot how much money it was. Let's say $1,500. Well, I'd never seen that much money in my whole life. And so I went about the chore of figuring out how to make that into $1 million because I read somebody had done that in the commodities market. So I invested it all in corn futures, and about 2 weeks later, I lost it all. So there were two things I learned about that. One was never to invest in the commodities market. I never did. Two, there were people out there who cared about my future as an Indiana lawyer and cared enough to make a scholarship available. And I vowed that if I ever could, ever in the position to do something about that, I would do the same thing. I would create some money to help the law school and provide education for kids. And so it came to pass that I was able to come up with a little money, and I did contribute a bunch of the money to the law school. And so that, and answer your question, is one of the things I was passionate about.
It's fantastic. On another topic, I know that you're a bit of a movie buff, and you even made a movie. How did you come to make the movie Diving In, and what was memorable about that experience?
You had said earlier in my introduction, which was very gracious, I appreciate it, that I didn't fail at anything. That's a terrible takeaway from an interview with me, because an entrepreneur who's out there has to learn to deal with failure. We lost money in Diving In, but there was a lot of excitement and a lot of fun. It was a good experience, a good learning experience. I enjoyed it all. The creative part was the most important, but dealing with those rascals in California. Incidentally, I tell people that work for me that there are a lot of countries in which we shouldn't do business, and one of them is California.
Right. So Diving In, it lost money, but I remember vividly one of the things you have talked about in the past, which I always get a kick out, is one of the movie critics gave it a review. What was that review?
In Orlando, Diving In, it was a movie about a coming-of-age movie on the high school diving team. And the Orlando review said, "Diving In goes straight to the bottom." The local folks in Indiana, they were kind, and they gave it a good review.
And there were some famous people in that movie, right?
We fostered a lot of careers. We needed a bully, and we were just filming kind of by the seat of our pants, so we needed a bully the next day. And my wife recalled that our plumber was over with his grandson, who was huge. And it turned out he was 6'7" tall. And he said, "Why don't you call our plumber and see if his grandson would come and be our bully?" And we did. And his name was Ben Ruby. And he went on, discovered from somebody watching our movie, and sent him to Hollywood. He's never come home from except to visit. He's a Hollywood actor. And he was in a major motion picture and a few other pictures. And he was on TV on a regular series. So we did launch his career.
Isn't there a famous actor that was in maybe some of the Rocky movies?
We wanted to cast some good people. So we talked about casting Burt Lancaster. And there's a book. And you open the book to under L and you see Lancaster. And it tells his agent and the number. And we just picked up the phone and talked to Burt Lancaster's agent. And I said, "We have $50,000 allocated for this role." And then when the laughter finally subsided, we decided that we were kind of batting out of our league. But as we were looking at it all, we said, "Well, what about Burt Young? I mean, it's a Burt." So we asked Burt Young. And his agent, which was his brother, said, "Well, Burt Young got, I forgot how much, a few hundred thousand for his last role in Rocky 2 or 3 or whatever it was. I don't remember." And I said, "Well, can he use $50,000? "Well, sure." "So is he available next week?" Again, we were trying to film as we go. "Yeah, he is." He says, "Okay, we'll send him in. We'll send you a check for $50,000. He said, "Well, okay." He arrived by train, and Burt Young didn't really act because he was Burt Young. That's the way he was. A delightful man, and added to a lot of fun on the set. So there's another story. We had a bunch of stories like that.
It's amazing all the experiences you've had, so many memorable ones and fun stories. But we've made it, Mickey, to off the record speed round, where I'm going to give you some questions. You try to give me quick answers. You can go on a little bit. You don't have to be too quick. But I'll start out with, what's your favorite movie?
Lawrence of Arabia. Back in the days of epics, it was the best one.
Favorite place to vacation?
Costa Rica. I feel like a new man in Costa Rica. Fresh fish every day, exercise, perfect weather. It's a hell of a place.
Favorite musical artist?
Frank Sinatra. Now, that shows my age. I know some of the others. I'm available. I mean, I'm cognizant of the many good artists that are around, but I like Sinatra, and I still do.
That's a good one. What's the first thing you do in the morning?
You're getting personal. Of course, I'm 81, so I don't do that every morning.
Go to the bathroom.
Yeah,
okay.
You know, go to the bathroom, unlock the door, get the newspaper.
Title of the last book you read?
I kind of give you a sideways answer to that. Death on the Wing. Have you ever heard of it?
Mm-mm.
You know why? Because it's the title of my sequel that I'm writing right now. And when I say the last book I read, we're in our 50th draft, which is what I try to do. I work and work and work until I get it right. People say to me, boy, writing comes so easily. No, writing does not. So the last book I read, and I read it ad nauseum, is Death on the Wing.
What food can you not live without?
I would say, from a health point of view, fish. So I have really pivoted to a fish diet, not exclusively, because if you put a good steak in front of me and it's served at a dinner party or something, I'll be happy to eat it. But when I am out, I opt for fish.
What's the best advice you ever received?
Don't sell the IBJ.
Well,
I didn't say it was the best advice I ever took, but that was damn good advice.
It was good advice. I'm glad you held out for me. You waited for me to be the buyer.
I obviously didn't take that advice.
I like it. Advice for a young person who wants to become a leader.
Read my business book.
Good advice. Yeah. Really good advice.
I've got it. I think we have a couple hundred left. We published many thousands, but we're pretty much at the end of that.
That's a great read. And as I mentioned earlier, I highly recommend it. So last question, easy one for you. Joe Biden or Donald Trump?
I would, Joe Biden for sure, but just to add, I would vote for Attila the Hun before I'd vote for Donald Trump.
So maybe a write-in candidate, or if you had to choose those, you already made your choice, okay.
I know people are saying that Joe Biden is too old, et cetera, but being 81 myself, I think us old-timers are capable, and I think Joe's done a good job, pretty good job. So I'm a Biden fan.
Well, Mickey, we're going to leave it at that. Thank you so much for joining me on the Indiana 250 podcast. Thank you for your friendship, your mentorship, and the opportunity to continue on such a wonderful tradition here at the IBJ. And thanks on behalf of everybody. Thanks for all you've done for our city, our community, and our state, Mickey.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm honored. This has been enjoyable, Nate, and I wish you well in this endeavor for you. I know you'll do very well.
Thanks, Mickey. Thanks to Mickey Maurer for our conversation today. To learn more about other leaders on IBJ Media's Indiana 250 list, go to indiana250.com and look for a page 2 feature each week in IBJ. We'll be back with the new Indiana 250 off-the-record conversation soon.